there are other ways of using language and recovering a greater vocabulary, a fuller language that will allow us more nuanced relationship to our own emotions. And I'm interested in complex emotions where it's often not just one thing that we feel, because in my experience, that's rarely the case. So I think poetry can offer an expanded vocabulary, an expanded way of using language and rhythm that makes us more attentive.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. This week, my guest is Forrest Gander. Forrest Gander is a poet, novelist, and essayist based in Northern California, whose most recent book of poems, entitled Be With, was awarded the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. On top of that book, entitled Be With, Forrest has published 9 other poetry collections, including his 2012 book, Core Samples from the World, which was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Forrest has written 2 novels, essay collections, and translates poetry in multiple languages, including Spanish and Japanese. Forrest has taught poetry at both Harvard and Brown universities, and his life and work as a poet is definitely the focus of our conversation today. In that conversation, we discuss the life-changing moment that made him forego a safe and stable career to pursue this life as a poet, what he thinks makes a poem not just good, but great, and why poetry continues to be such a significant art form for allowing people to express themselves and process both the beauty and tragedy in life. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Forrest Gander. Forrest Gander, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. It's a pleasure to be in your home today. This is lovely space. So can you describe for the audience a little bit about where we're speaking right now?
So we're speaking on the west side of Petaluma and looking at the Sonoma Mountain with one big redwood tree between us and the mountain, on which occasionally perches a crow at the very top.
Do you think it's the same crow?
I don't know. I think they probably jostle for king of the world there.
So as we are both Sonoma County residents, what is one of your favorite parts about living in Sonoma County?
I'm so glad to be in California. I was born in California and went to grad school in San Francisco and always wanted to come back here. And the landscape just kills me. You know, I drove an Irish artist today out to Point Reyes and just identifying my favorite trees on the way out there and those right now very brown hills. It just fills my heart.
Mm. Is the landscape that you speak about, does that influence your work? Specifically like the Sonoma County landscape?
Yeah, very much so. I've been the book that I just sent to my publisher, New Directions, is very much influenced. As you may know, I'm interested in what has come to be called eco-poetics, which is a way of sort of negotiating or writing about our relationship to nature, but breaking down the distinction between self and nature, because we're so, you know, to separate them is really artificial. We are nature. Nature is in us. Even in our bodies, we have biomes of other species living and parasites that long ago, their DNA is integrated into our DNA. So we're a community as an individual. So I'm interested in the relationship between how we live in an environment and how the environment affects us. And it turns out that there's, and so that's eco-poetics. poetry is sort of working with that, differing from a kind of previous poetry of nature like Mary Oliver. And it turns out that in southern India, between 300 BC and 300 AD, there is this flourishing of literature called Sangam poetry, in which they're thinking of the same issues. And there's they write about subjectivity, personal emotion, in a way that's completely invested with landscape.
Very interesting. And so when you, eco-poetics, is that what you, the term? So when you write eco-poetry, how much time do you spend in those places that you're writing about? Are you camping in the woods? Are you going on walks at Point Reyes? Like, how ingrained in the nature do you need to be to express that?
You know, a lot of, I think a lot of art is about listening, and just like prayer is, according to Simone Weil. And so you have to be in a place where you can be attentive enough to listen and not just hear yourself anymore. So I do spend a lot of time in this fantastic Northern California landscape. Just came back from Montgomery Woods with this Irish artist, and that was just beautiful. You know, we, a 3-mile loop, we took 4 hours to walk, and it felt great.
Yeah. And so when you're in those spaces like Montgomery Woods, are you in those spaces thinking about, I want to write a poem about this space? Or are you just observing, and then maybe when you get back to where you write, whether that's here or somewhere else, you kind of let those observations flow through you and see what comes out?
So, yeah, that's an interesting interesting question. I mean, Wordsworth talks about poetry being something that you reflect on after the experience. And it's true that if you try too hard to articulate what you're feeling at the moment that you're feeling it, you can sort of interfere with the fullness of feeling. But I'm a writer, and so I am taking notes and then being shut up by just the awe of the experience, and then taking notes, and then listening and being shut up by the awe of the experience. So it's a dialogue with listening and note taking that I'll come back to write something.
Yeah, I kind of see a parallel in like my filmmaking process, which is sometimes I will spend, you know, a few days straight in the field where I'm shooting constantly. And then when it comes to the editing or the crafting of the story, I have this this feeling that pulls in two different directions. One is like, I'm tired and I feel like I need some time away from that material to be able to bring it together in something coherent. And the other side of that pulls towards, I just filmed this thing. I was so present in the emotions and the story happening in front of me. I should go into the editing software right now and get something down to capture that feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like with film even more, you have a record of the rhythm of the experience. And that's something you can lose with writing once you get too far away from it. You can have notes, but they're separated from like the pulse of an experience. And but in film, you look back and you can track that pulse.
Yeah. Yeah, the rhythm and pulse, those are two nice words for it. And I'd like to get back to the rhythm and pulse and kind of the beats of your work in a moment. But I thought it'd be useful to just hear a little bit about your background or kind of your origin story, if you will, about how you became a poet.
So I was born, the beginning of an origin story, in the Mojave Desert in Barstow. And my mother fell in love with the desert, so I heard about it a lot as a child, even after we'd moved away. And I was raised by my mother in a family of women, two sisters, a mom and a grandmother. My father wasn't around much. And my mother's father was a Swede who used to stomp around her house as a child, and later I heard him reciting poetry. It was, you know, that generation of people born in the early part of the 20th century. Everyone memorized poems. There were a lot of popular poems. And so she grew up with poetry in her ear, and she used to read me as a kid, you know, Carl Sandburg and Edgar Allan Poe, the bells, 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 bells. And I started writing early on, and thought by the time I was in high school that I was a pretty hotshot poet. And then my freshman year in college at the College of William and Mary in Virginia, I showed my poetry to a professor, David Jenkins, who read some and looked me in the eye in this little cabin outside the Wren Chapel, where we had classes. He said, "Forrest, these are terrible." And then I choked up and thought, oh, it's not just like self-expression. I need to learn something about the art. Mm. I'd been reading poetry, but not so much contemporary poetry. But that, from then on, I began to take more seriously the craft of it. And it's been, you know, a long, many years of learning. And I think maybe like you too, I were talking about looking at earlier work and
right.
later work, but I hope always to stay somewhat of an amateur. I don't want to feel like I really completely have mastered something.
Yeah.
And then close off the possibilities for learning more.
Absolutely.
That for you too?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I feel like such an infant when it comes to documentary filmmaking, for sure. So can you say a little bit more about that? It's not just self-expression. There are things about the craft that you wanted to learn. There's probably a lot of people out here who are listening who have never studied poetry. So what do you mean by the craft of poetry? What are some things that are in there?
So, I mean, all writing serves lots of different functions, and poetry can be just self-expression. It can be a way of dealing with your trauma by just writing it out. But because it takes place in a history, it can be useful for you personally to write that love is like a rose, but historically, when you realize that metaphor has been used up, that you need to say something different if it's going to last, you begin to realize that knowing something about the history of the work and the technique of the work is what will distinguish whether what you're doing is just for yourself or is going to be part of the art of your time. Rimbaud says, you know, energy always flows into new forms. And all of us, you as a filmmaker and I as a writer, are looking for new ways to express human emotions that are very old.
Right. So when you're talking about learning the craft, when maybe this was at the time when you were in grad school, perhaps at San Francisco State, was that a time when you were going back into the history of poetry and now you use those historical references or that knowledge of history as just a point to jump off from?
Yeah. Cormac McCarthy says books are made from books, and I think everybody gets, or most people, and tell me if this is true of your experience, get on board the bus of their art in their own time. It's like what's happening right now is what interests people in poetry. So maybe rap is a young person's first introduction to poetry or to the film of your moment. But when you become passionate about something or about someone, you want to learn all about them. And the more you learn, the more you find it defines the trajectory for how you move into a future with it. So I came into poetry reading 20th century poetry, but, you know, as I got passionate, I wanted to know more. I went backward and then also wanted to know what was happening in other countries in poetry. So I've had a lot of interest in translation, and I have a lot of interest now in what poets are doing, what writers are doing all around the world. And with you?
Yeah, similar. I mean, I almost feel bad that when people ask me for documentaries that I recommend, pretty much all of mine are contemporary. And I think that I would benefit a lot from doing what you're saying, because I did not go to film school. I didn't study the films of the past.
That can be an advantage, not having been to school for something.
Yeah, it can be. And sometimes I feel like maybe I shouldn't watch so much, because then I'm just approaching the craft with like no influence. But I know that there is a huge benefit to understanding what people who have done, who have come before me have done, and what I can take from them. So it's definitely, I'm starting to go through the archives a little bit of kind of like the historically great documentaries.
But you're young, and what you've done is eaten up everything around you right now. That's the way to, you know, to be in it.
So when you finished grad school and you were launching your career as a poet, what was another moment where like things were hard, or like things just like weren't going the way you planned, and you're like, damn, like this is a hardship.
Yeah.
With you trying to be a poet.
Well, no one really, I mean, it's, you know, it's a funny way of phrasing it, a career as a poet, because there is no like way of making a living doing it. And so, of course, it's hard. You have to figure out a way to make money otherwise. I worked at a methadone clinic for a year in San Francisco, the advantage of which was I met people that knew Neil Young, and I really wanted to meet Neil Young, which the closest I came was changing the tire of someone who stayed up at Neil Young's farm, but who didn't invite me out. Beautiful woman beating a heroin habit. And what was the question, Austin?
Question was, yeah, just early struggles that you may have had.
So, yeah, your parents. So I have a degree in geology, and that would have been a secure way of making a living. And as the only male, basically, in my family, and as the oldest child, I felt some responsibility to have a responsible job. But the year after I graduated from undergraduate school, I had cancer. I had third stage melanoma, which was only five stages, so it was a close one. And in the hospital, I had time to think about, well, if my life was going to be shorter than I was hoping it would be, what did I want to spend it doing? And what I loved most, my passion, though I couldn't connect it to an income, was writing. But I made the decision to try to figure that out. So it's meant lots of different kinds of jobs, you know, for for a long time. I worked at a methadone clinic. I worked up to the time of getting married as a waiter. I was a good waiter. And it was a, it gave me the opportunity to focus on the thing I cared most about and at the same time make a small amount of money to at least be able to live. And meanwhile, you know, my mom, and then she marries a wonderful man who I call my father, Walter Gander, whose name I end up taking. You know, they're worried about me. They're seeing somebody who they thought was fairly bright, making what seems to them to be choices that will guarantee my poverty forever. So it's not until I first get grants, my first awards, that they begin to think that I may be following a path that would be viable.
Sounds like, in that moment you had to have faith that...
You have to have faith. You have to have enough passion that all the wrong turnings and disappointments don't turn you back. What about you? It must be similar.
Yes.
But you've been getting grants already and traveling to Zambia. I mean, you've had some big things going on already.
I've been fortunate enough to get some grants. And I think one of the big moments for me was coming out of grad school. I was, there were a lot of parts about journalism I was disillusioned with. And it wasn't until I got this kind of fellowship, which I mentioned to you before, with Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times. He was the first time, that was the first moment that I got to see right next to me the potential. See someone right next to me doing the craft at the highest level.
Yeah.
And say like, wow, here's someone who's making impact. And like, I could see myself doing something like that. I think it's so important to have those examples. And I didn't get it when it's just like reading a textbook. You know what I mean? So that was like a moment where it was like, this is possible.
I love that. And I look for models too. Even now, I look for models of older writers who aren't repeating themselves, older artists who aren't repeating themselves, who are still making discoveries in their work. I got to visit a couple years ago before my wife died. In fact, the last thing we did together, we traveled to Chile, to Santiago, and we visited with the 101-year-old Nicanor Parra, a great Chilean poet, the poet who sort of changed poetry after Neruda had made all poetry seem like it needed to be that beautiful, lyrical, sensual, techno-color poetry. And Nicanor Parra, who had a degree in engineering from Brown University, was using a language of science and street vernacular and humor, and that that opened up possibilities for writers all through Latin America. So it's really cool to get to meet him that at that age when he was still writing, still still making things happen.
So as someone who's been writing poetry for so long, is that a fear or something you think about? Like, is a fear that I'm just repeating myself?
Well, you've seen it with artists already. I mean, people have not so many ideas. You know, one theory is that even a great artist has basically one idea. And so artists come to... John Ashbery says, repetition makes reputation. And he says it archly, but you see a lot of people repeating the things they've been praised for. And I'm really dissatisfied with that myself. I don't want to do that. So each of my books has been very different. And I'm trying to learn something new as I go into each next project.
Mm. What do you think makes a poem great compared to just okay or just good?
I think a poem or any, like any art, has to have enough openness in it to allow for different interpretations and for nuance. It can't be like the art in the recent Whitney Biennial, that a lot of which was very political, but political art is often not very nuanced, and literature is full of great artists writing really bad pieces that aren't open enough, that close down, that are too obvious, that use languages of, you know, slogans, and that work doesn't last very long. It can serve a purpose, but you know, Neruda's poem to Stalin, well, it was never really good at any time, but it's he's a, you know, a great artist that could write bad poetry too. So I think that sense of enough space in a work that the viewer or reader can engage with it and respond to it, and that is feels called to do that because the solution or the meaning or its impact isn't too simple.
Hmm. And how do you go about creating that kind of openness?
The same way I think that you do. I mean, the language of film, which has rhythmic movement and image repertoire and a soundtrack are the same ingredients of writing, that that pacing is something. You can't have everything paced at the same speed, and the image repertoire has to vary, or it looks like everything's, you know, painted with purple, or and translation has added a lot to my technique in translating work, mostly from Spanish, but also from Japanese. I've learned to enter the minds of people, of other people, who have different relations to syntax and putting words together and texture in language, and that's added to the things that I can do that I didn't come with.
Yeah. It's an interesting experience for me reading Be With, the book you won the Pulitzer for. Congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, thank you.
And talking about this concept of openness and the space for multiple interpretations. I was reading your book, and a memory is called to me reading it in a tent, in a tent, reading your book. And it's one of the reasons that I think that one is open and allows for multiple interpretations. It is challenging to read. Is that I'm reading words in ways I've never seen them. I'm reading specific words that I was like going to my phone to look up sometimes. Rhythmically, it's like all the patterns I'm used to are suddenly changed. And I think because my mind is challenged in that new way, like I just think that leads to openness and like naturally, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that I'm not interested in an art that's not communicating something that's so open that anyone can say, well, this is about
right
whatever. But I do think that what lasts in poetry, as Ezra Pound says, only emotion endures. Mm-hmm. So we read a fragment of a poem that Sappho wrote 2,600 years ago, and that we can feel something, that we can feel, you know, an emotion in that. But Pound translation of Sappho, just three fragmented lines: spring, too long, Gangula, where Gangula is a woman's name. Mm. You can feel something in that, and that can be communicated, 2,600 years after that language disappeared from the face of the earth, is just so remarkable. So the what I want people to feel in poetry is emotion, but our emotions are tied up in the way that we use language, and most of us, almost all of us, fall into ruts of language. We have a limited, number of words that we use in common phrases to get through each day, and a limited way of reading when we read a newspaper, because we're looking for, facts, things to be discovered. But there are other ways of using language, and of recovering a greater vocabulary, a more, a fuller language that will allow us more nuanced relationship to our own emotions. And I'm interested in complex emotions where it's often not just one thing that we feel, because in my experience, that's rarely the case.
Yeah.
So I think poetry can offer an expanded vocabulary, an expanded way of using language and rhythm that makes us more attentive. Mm. So it can be read well in a tent, like you were.
That's fantastic. I'm also really interested to talk a little bit about the actual form in which your poems take place, or syntactically how they're written. And this has been on my mind recently because I recently read a novel called A Place for Us, and beautiful novel. And it's a lot about memory, and it's told from multiple perspectives, all from this one family, and they're going back into their memories, remembering moments within their family. And it's not in chronological order. It jumps around. And in a lot of ways, the way that the prose is written kind of mirrors the theme. It's like kind of the way your memory works. Like, it doesn't work in that linear fashion.
Yes.
It jumps around, and so does the book. And I think poetry does this so fantastically, and the stuff that I've studied in school and looking at yours, and how your form mirrors the themes or the actual content of the poems. How do you think about the form and when you're writing?
Well, that's why I was excited about the way that you were talking about story when you first introduced yourself and talked to me, because I'm really not interested. I mean, I write novels also, mm-hmm. and essays, and I'm not interested in simple story and the sort of beginning, denouement, and ending, because that cliche of story narrative doesn't account for my own experience of the world, mm-hmm. which is so overlaid and palimpsestic. And so I'm interested in complex stories that have different layers. And like you say, like, even while someone is listening to this, they're watching where they're driving.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
And they're thinking about something that happened to them today, and they're having a sexual memory or an erotic memory or a memory of something painful that's happened to them. And that happens at the same time in our system. And to be able to write a kind of consciousness that is more accurately enacting the way we experience each other in the world is part of what interests me about what poetry can do.
Mm-hmm. And when you're writing, because of like how unique some of your phrasing is and the word choice you use, does that just come out of your head and onto the paper? Or do you write, does what come out of your head look kind of like what comes out of my head, which is like the language that I would read a newspaper with? And then you like study that sentence and kind of craft it into something that makes the reader pause and actually see or feel exactly what you're trying to convey.
Yeah. So most of my work comes from notes instead of like a full journalistic sentence. So there, it has a fragmentary quality to begin with, but thematically often connected. And it takes, no, I do, like Allen Ginsberg says, first thought, best thought, but that doesn't work for me. Mm. You know, maybe if you're a genius, you can do that, but I've given up trying to represent myself as a genius, even to myself. Mm. So it's lots and lots of revision to try to find a way of making the writing engaging, in to make it, allow it to be surprising without it being just constantly convulsive. Mm. But to lure the reader in, because there's something unfamiliar and there's something familiar.
Mm. Something, there's something familiar. Can you say that line again?
There's something unfamiliar.
Yeah.
But there's something familiar too.
Right. Oh, I like that. I gotta write that one.
Mm,
okay. when I think about poetry and the tradition of poetry, I know there's a lot of like oral tradition. Do you think about when you're writing poetry about how it sounds?
Totally.
Out loud.
Very much so. And I think anybody like myself who's translated poetry knows that sound is really key for it. And so one reads one's own work out loud. Here's a beautiful little old poem in Japanese from the Manyoshu, and it's all about sound. So if you, so I'll tell you the poem first. Kure yako no yuku mo gaeru mo wakarete wa shiru mo shiranu mo Osaka no seki. So it's a 5-7-5-7-7. Kure, kure yako no, yuku mo gaeru mo. But what you hear are all these long O sounds, right?
Yeah.
Coming into the sort of last line, Osaka no seki, because the old word for Osaka, the city of Osaka in Japanese, had a double O in it. This poem, which is about longing, which is about people leaving each other at this border wall where the men would go on a journey, is acted out in these deep, resonant, long O sounds, which tend to be connected to deeper emotions, according to linguists like Reuven Sur, than the tweeter sounds.
Mm.
And so to translate this poem just semantically is to completely ruin it, because it's just like,
here
we go, saying goodbye at the wall in Osaka.
Right.
But the long O's bring out the emotion of it. So to translate it, you have to be very attuned to trying to communicate a similar sound in English.
Oh, wow, that's really challenging.
And in any poem, the sound is a part of its meaning. Because we, even before we understand what a word means, the sound has an effect on our bodies.
Hmm. And do you feel the same way when you're writing an essay or a novel?
Well, the way I write novels, I'm really interested in the quality of the language.
Okay.
All the way through. An essay, less so.
Okay.
Let's say pacing is still more a part of it. But I think particularly with poetry, as you say, because it comes, you know, it's an oral art. It comes out of repetition and in with Homer, you know, words that reorient you and restart something, that the listening is a really important part of it.
Yeah, and I feel that as a reader too, because even when I'm in my tent reading, I'm not reading your poems out loud. I'm reading them in my head, but I think I have this understanding, and also the way they're written, not only the sounds that the words have, but like, you know, sometimes you'll have words that are like spaced unevenly, and I'm thinking, oh, he wants me to like take a little bit more of a breath here.
Yeah.
And so even that, I'm not saying it out loud, but in my head, I'm feeling that tempo, I'm feeling that rhythm, and wondering to myself, I wonder why he wants me to do that.
And that's in the book Be With, there are a number of poems that have what we call technically a caesura, so a space between the words in a line, which is what the Anglo-Saxon poets also did. And one of the ways I find it useful is it breaks up the natural iambic patterns that people in English often talk in, and a pentameter line, which is a really common sort of phrasing in English. So it breaks that up. And also for me, it has this little erotic delay, so that part of a sentence goes and there's this little pause and it pulls you into the next part. Because you're waiting for something to be fulfilled, for the syntax to complete itself. But that little pause, I find, is a little moment of longing for union. And the book was very much about a longing for union.
Yeah, how that form, the form matches that theme.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm telling stories through photography, I'm always thinking about what is a singular moment that tells a story. What is a moment I can capture where when the viewer looks at it, they see the whole world and the whole before and the after of that story. When I'm shooting video, I'm thinking about a sequence of moments that tied together will tell a story. I wonder kind of on that spectrum of like a moment, a singular moment to a sequence, how you think about stories in poetry. If that even resonates at all.
Yeah, that's really an interesting question that I may need to think about for a second or for a year. a lot of poetry has to do with transition and juxtaposition. Now, I'm not going to come up with a good... That's too
okay.
good a question.
Oh,
yeah,
it's okay.
It's a really... I would have to think about it. Yeah.
Because sometimes, I mean, when I was reading, I was like, that question popped into my head while I was reading your work. And sometimes I think in poetry, it can even be even a smaller unit than a moment. It might be a single like emotion or a single feeling. Yeah, maybe there's not much more to say on it.
There's interestingly, I've done a lot of collaborations with photographers, not with filmmakers very much, though I'm interested in film too, and also in making poetry films. But you know, you'll see in the next room, I've collaborated with Sally Mann, with a wonderful Mexican photographer named Graciela Iturbide, with a fantastic younger photographer, lives in San Francisco, though he's all over the world, named Lucas Folia. I really love, there's something about photography that really opens up my imagination and my my resonant feeling space, so that I've wanted to not practice that art because I'm no good at it, but I've wanted to work with photographers.
No, that's neat. One of the reasons that poetry has been on my mind a lot lately is because I was just actually in Jordan for a couple weeks doing a film project out there. And the story I was filming was about an Iraqi refugee who lives in Amman, who's a poet. And this past year, he started a poetry program in the largest Syrian refugee camp in the world for kids there. And so I told the story of this poet and followed him on his bus ride into the camp and teaching these kids poetry. And we talked a lot about on that trip the value of poetry and writing and self-expression for these kids and what they've gone through in their lives. Your book, Be With, is also about grieving and about loss. And I wonder what you think poetry or just writing in general or storytelling, what can that offer people when they're experiencing some of those emotions?
I think it's this rare gift we have to be able to articulate our world and offer it to someone else. And without the words, without arriving into words for doing that, we're left with rage and grief that can lead to violence or suicide, and often does. And that the struggle to find expression for what we're feeling is the struggle to be a living human being. So in lots of refugee camps, I can also name right now, there are a lot of poetry workshops in Bangladesh right now with the Rohingya. I have friends, wonderful English poet James Byrne has been teaching poetry workshops, and some of the poets I know who grew up in refugee camps in Vietnam and experienced tremendous trauma found a way of living beyond that trauma through writing. So that it didn't just pull them under.
Mm. And I saw an interview with you where you say, like, this book, it kind of just came out of you. Like, it just, you had to write it. It's not like, I think the question someone asked you was, you know, when you wrote it, were you going for the Pulitzer? And it's just like, no, like, it just, no. I needed to write it. Did you have something?
Go ahead.
I think that was a beautiful sentiment and also so important for people out there to hear. Like a lot of storytelling is like self-therapy. It's a way, it's okay if no one reads it or if no one sees it. And I just think that's worthwhile as well.
It is, right. I mean, no one sees Emily Dickinson's poems, which are incredibly emotionally riven, and they've lasted for, you know, and will last forever. Yeah, I think that serving self-expression is one of the things that writing can do. And then the more seriously you take it, the more you begin to connect it to an art and begin to hone it. Yeah. By learning more about the form. Mm.
So before we wrap up the main show here, where should we send people if they're interested in reading your work or following you? Where's the best place that we should have them go?
I'm not very followable on social media anymore. I've stopped using Facebook and I haven't used Twitter, and a lot of my friends are on Instagram, including my son, who's a sculptural furniture maker.
Oh, neat.
And but my books are easy to find.
There you go.
My books are in bookstores, or can and if you look my name up online, people come to my website, and that offers a lot of information and interviews and recommendations for reading, things that I've like to share.
And when is your new book out?
I just sent it to my editors at New Direction, New Direction's publishers in New York, and I've heard back from my editor. He liked it, but the process at New Directions, which is this great old press that sort of brought modernism to the United States, is all of the editors have to read it and agree to publish it. So
oh, okay.
I'm kind of waiting around to hear
if
they've liked it. And I hope it might come out in 2020, at the end of 2020. And it's a lot about, curiously, it's a lot about lichen. The whole book is sort of based on lichen, which other poets, California poets like Brenda Hillman, for instance, have written a lot about. But I've been able to work with a mycologist up in Michigan named Ann Pringle, who you'll see in the New York Times writing a lot about mushrooms and lichen. And she has a theory that our whole sense of death as human beings is naturally based on being interested in mammals, but that it may be that lichen doesn't age. And if lichen doesn't age, there may be other things that don't age. And then lichen also is, as we all learned in high school, these two things that come together, cyanobacteria or algae and a fungi, and they form a synergistic thing. But it's way more complicated than that. And the things that start out give up the properties that they have to become something new that may not age. Mm. And that seems like a beautiful metaphor for intimacy for me.
Yeah.
And so my book is the new book, which is called Twice Alive, is about California landscape, lichen, and intimacy.
And that gets back to the eco-poetry that we were
talking
about.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I will say to the folks out there, a delightful little story of mine was when I went to buy your book at Copperfields in Santa Rosa, they were sold out, which I was very excited about. I was excited about the inconvenience that people were out there buying poetry and enjoying it.
That's good, I guess. Yeah.
So the question I finish all my shows on are by asking, what advice do you have for people out there who want to become better storytellers? Obviously, we've given a lot of great insight in here. I've learned a ton from you today. But if there's one thing that you'd want to kind of leave people with in terms of becoming better storytellers, what would that be?
Well, I think it's to become obsessed, to not sleep, to drink coffee and wine, and to just immerse yourself in good stories, in good documentaries, in good good fiction, in good poetry, that you immerse yourself in something and you keep soaking up the things that you can use yourself. Jackson Brown has a simple way of saying something about, you know, you make your dance from all the other dances that you've seen. So the other approach, that you don't want your work to be influenced by other people's work, and so you don't read or look at other people's work, doesn't have many success stories.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Austin.
Yeah,
looking forward to seeing your films.
That's it for episode 29 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you so much to Forrest Gander for coming on the show and to you for listening. If you want to hear more with Forrest, he and I did record a special post-show where I asked him some of the questions we didn't get to in the main show, including how his life has changed since winning the Pulitzer Prize. And I think his answer might surprise you. If you want to hear all of that, you can listen to this week's private podcast exclusively on Patreon. Patreon is a subscription platform where you can pledge as little as $2 a month and get access to all the post shows with my guests and additional bonus episodes. If you subscribe to the Austin Meyer Private Podcast on Patreon, you will also receive a personal link so that my private episodes play in your favorite podcast app. So head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms to check that out. If you want to get in touch with me directly, please reach out on social @AustinMeyerFilms. I love hearing from listeners about what is resonating with you. And also, if you have guest ideas, who would you like to hear me interview about the craft of storytelling? Send me a message. Who's on your mind? I think that's it from me. So I will see you next episode on the Austin Meyer Podcast. And until then, go out and tell some stories.